Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Joyce Carol Oates began working on The Accursed in 1984 after moving to Princeton, New Jersey, the setting for the novel. After abandoning the project for nearly 30 years, she revisited the subject and completed the manuscript within several months. Fascinated by her adopted hometown's storied history, she shaped her plot around the years 1905 to 1906, fashioning a haunting scenario that hinges on disruptive dreams of ghosts and vampires and a shape-shifting presence who just might be the devil. The name of the novel is The Accursed, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Joyce Carol Oates back to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. That was a terrific summary of the novel. I'm kind of riveted.
It's a beautiful novel. And to try to even summarize something of 600-plus pages of such craftsmanship is very difficult. Give me a sense of at what point you knew that this was something that you wanted to revisit.
Well, as I probably had mentioned somewhere or other, I kept going back to it because it was like a riddle. I didn't feel that I had the narrative voice. I wasn't happy with the length, and I needed to restructure it. Basically, I kept most of the plot, or maybe all of the plot, and all of the characters. I didn't add anything. I sort of edited and trimmed and put things together and had a more contemporary narrative voice. Originally, it had been more 19th century.
The novel, as I mentioned, I mean, if you take it to its simplest form, the plot is about this 14-month curse manifesting in Princeton, New Jersey from 1905 to 1906. This affects the town's elite. What is it about that time period?
Yeah, the time period was very crucial because it was sort of the apex of Woodrow Wilson's feud with this dean, which completely consumed most of his life. I mean, like 90% of his life, he was just so consumed with this unfortunate feud. And it came to an end at that time. And he had a stroke. And just many, many things seemed to be coming together. It was a time when Upton Sinclair's The Jungle was being serialized. And that was very important also. So it's really kind of an exciting time, I thought.
Woodrow Wilson, of course, president of Princeton University. Upon your arrival at Princeton, how much did you know about the story going in?
Oh, nothing. I arrived at Princeton and was quite ravished by the Revolutionary War history that was all around. And it's very rich in historical detail. And I put some of that in the novel. And I just did research into the university and the area, the town, especially the village, very affluent village, and got really interested in Woodrow Wilson, who, of course, at the time was considered a reformer and, you know, sort of a leader. Today we think of him as extremely racist and misogynist. And now, you know, there's a different feeling about him. But I think generally he's still revered. He's still admired.
What I found fascinating about the novel is how beautifully you take this reality, this familiar reality, and yet bring us through this wonderful surrealism. I assume that that is a delicate balance.
I think of it as a delicate balance, but not always certain whether this is a visitation from the unconscious, a sort of a psychological fantasy, or something like a dream element during the daytime. Is it a hallucination?
Right.
I thought of the emergence of the demons and the vampires as the return of the repressed, that these are things that are emerging because there's been a repression.
Were you instantly comfortable with writing this Gothic prose?
I have several novels in the same mode. I would consider them postmodernist Gothics. The first is called Bellefleur.
Right.
And then there's A Bludsmer Romance and Mysteries of Winterturn and My Heart Laid Bare. They're basically like 19th century chronicles, though this one is not in the 19th century, but it's before World War One. It's as if the 19th century, you know, goes up until World War One, so to speak, in that Victorian era. Yes, I'm very comfortable with that. I love working with language, and I love the subtleties that were possible in 19th century prose. Lots of use of commas and semicolons and more words. They just use more words. And as you know, when Ernest Hemingway came along, he revolutionized language in prose fiction, but at the same time, he did away with a lot of subtlety. It's not that much. It's a different kind of consciousness and different kind of prose. So things are lost when you have a minimalist prose.
I love Bellefleur, and in reading that book, which came out, I guess, came out in 1980, which was shortly after you arrived at Princeton. So this,
right, that's right.
So you must have started this book shortly after writing that within that series of novels.
That's right. Yes, I did. It was one of the series, and it was so rich, if that's the right word, so much historical detail and notes and footnotes and things. I got rid of most of that, or I consolidated it.
In the writing of this book, is there, you said about length, and does 700 pages, when you think about it, are you still edited? Could you have done more, or do you feel that there is a freedom that comes with a large novel?
Yes, there's a certain amount of freedom, and you need a narrator, usually. You need a frame so that it's sort of set in place. Many 19th century novels have frames. For instance, Wuthering Heights has, I mean, it's just somehow a device that one uses, and Henry James uses that in The Turn of the Screw, to sort of set the Gothic vision inside a narrator rather than having it come seemingly directly from the author. And all these things, I think, are really very interesting.
They're fascinating. And when you take on a project like this, especially one that you started in 1980, do you feel that your maturation as an author allowed you to do this that perhaps you weren't ready for in 1980?
Well, that's true. And I needed just another turn of the screw. I needed a little more element, which turns out to be the refusal of the white ruling Christian class to acknowledge how badly African Americans were, or as they would say, Negroes, were being treated, you know, among them their own servants. And what a viciously discriminatory society it was, what a racist society. As soon as I thought of that theme, then I sort of had the narrator, the voice for the novel. I didn't seem to have that exactly in the beginning. In the beginning, it was more about what it was about other things, but that was not primary.
Did you know from the beginning how the curse would be broken?
Oh, yes, that was always there.
Mm-hmm.
That was always there.
So you knew where you were headed then?
Yes, the plot was always there. I just added some things and tightened some things. And I made people talk a little more. Josiah Slade is often talking about things that are, he's trying to elucidate the mystery. He's someone who represents the 20th century, actually, in his thoughts about evolutionary Darwinian theory, for instance, are really very 20th century.
The social injustices that you write, and specifically about cures for invalids, there's almost a rage that comes out in the prose.
Yes, of course. Yes, I did a lot of research into that. And I have a friend, Elaine Showalter, a noted feminist critic, and she has a book called Histories and one called The Female Malady, and the way women were really marginalized and exploited. You know, just to be a normal woman was considered sort of a psychopathological condition. The norm was a man, a white man.
Mm.
It's kind of the norm.
You write it so beautifully, but you can tell that there's a rage there.
Yeah, I suppose so. It's tempered with some humor.
Absolutely.
Oh.
When you look back on your work, is this a book that stands out to you, or do they all stand out in some way?
Well, this definitely does. Yes, I think because of Josiah Slade and Wilhelmina, and to some extent Mr. Ruggles, you know, that they represent people I really care about and points of view, and also Upton Sinclair. I really liked him a lot.
Mm.
His wonderful idealism and naivete, the kind of special characters. And often if I look at the novel, I really like Josiah Slade's, his questing. He's always questing, trying to figure out this mystery. And he just seems like a laudable young person. Now, I'm surrounded by young people, you know, because I'm a professor, and the idealism and even like the moral questing of a younger generation is very impressive.
Well, it is a beautiful and magnificent novel. It is called The Accursed. It is published by Echo. Joyce Carol Oates, an honor and a great pleasure to speak with you once again, and I wish you all the best of luck with this new novel. It's gorgeous.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Appreciate
bye
it.
Bye.
Thank you. Again, the name of the novel is The Accursed. It is published by Echo. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.